You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is not Friday. It is Thursday. But Friday, Bernie's not going to be around. So he's here with us today, which is even better because there's been so much going on that I know so many of you want to ask him about. I want to hear about Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome. Uh-oh. I'm not hearing you, Bernie, if you can hear me. You might want to check and make sure the ISDN line is hot. Let's check that thing. And it is. It is working. And okay. While Shano and the technical people over at the House or Senate studios, wherever Bernie is, try to work the details out, we will pick that up in just a moment. Senator Sanders and Senator Boxer, just an FYI, today introduced comprehensive legislation on climate change. This is like really cool stuff. I mean, the president talked about this in his State of the Union address. He said, let's do something before it's too late. You've heard my rants about the Permian extinction, which came about as a result of a 5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature from volcanic activity. So they're changing studios. Okay. So Bernie will be with us in just a few minutes. Apparently that studio wasn't working. But Senator Boxer and Senator Sanders have put together two pieces of legislation, the Climate Protection Act and the Sustainable Energy Act, and a number of people with them, by the way. Bill McKibben, who was arrested yesterday in front of the White House, was there. Mike Broun, who is going to be with us later on in the program, in the third hour of our program, along with actress Daryl Hannah, was arrested at the White House. She will be here on the show in another 2 hours. And, Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen, Meg Power, the National Community Action Foundation. They said Senators Sander and Boxer actually understand the depth of the climate problem we face. We're awful grateful to them for starting us down the legislative path that could reverse our disastrous course. And indeed, I absolutely agree. So this is really great news that this legislation has been put forward by Senators Sanders and Boxer. Barbara Boxer, good person. Meanwhile, Wayne LaPierre has apparently decided that the NRA is a political party. Can you come to any other conclusion? He's giving an official response tonight. In fact, it'll be during the last hour of our program. It's going to be around 5:15, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time today, Thursday. He's giving an official response to the State of the Union address. You know, two responses. A, as if anybody cares. But B, well, of course you got to care because it's Wayne LaPierre is such a freak show. It's like going to the circus. It's like, what's that guy with the pie going to do next? Or that guy with the water bottle. You know, it's just like, what are they going to do next? So Wayne LaPierre is going to give this speech. And at the same time yesterday or the day before, he released an op-ed that was published in the Daily Caller that the folks over at the Think Progress blog called, and these are their words, not mine, bizarre, a paranoid screed. Wayne LaPierre is apparently channeling Hunter S. Thompson. It's like I could come up with no other explanation except for the fact that Hunter S. Thompson was actually one of my heroes and a brilliant journalist, and Wayne LaPierre is just, you know, a little nutty. So anyhow, he's up to that. And then meanwhile, Congressman Paul Ryan, Senator Marco Rubio, they have said we don't need to increase the living wage, the minimum wage to a living wage. We don't. And you could argue $9 an hour isn't even a living wage, but, you know, hey, it's better than $7.25. They're strongly, in fact, arguing that there should be no increase in the minimum wage, saying that this is not a good thing. Marco Rubio, he said, the question is a minimum wage the best way to do it? In other words, to bring people out of the bottom of the economic ladder. And history has said the answer is absolutely not. In fact, the impact of a minimum wage usually is that businesses hire less people. End quote. Well, first of all, he should have said fewer people rather than less. But setting that aside, Rubio's wrong. History shows that when you raise the minimum wage, it actually creates jobs. Because minimum wage employees spend 100% of their income. And when they spend 100% of their income, That's money that gets pumped into the economy. They go to the local store. They buy something. That local store then has to buy products. Those products then have to be made by somebody and shipped by somebody. And those people are all, you know, and so many, many more jobs are created when minimum wage people have a few extra bucks in their pocket. You know, the flip side of that, of course, is when billionaires have a few extra bucks in their pocket, you know, it's, I mean, what does Mitt Romney do with a few extra bucks? He puts them in a Swiss bank account. That's not going to stimulate the economy. Okay, I am told that Senator Sanders is with us. Bernie, are you there?
Right here, Tom. How are you?
Oh, great. And it's great to see you as well. Senator Sanders is with us. He, as I mentioned, just to reset this up, you're not going to be available tomorrow, so we're doing brunch with Bernie a day early. What's going on, Bernie?
Well, Tom, a whole lot is going on. This morning, Senator Barbara Boxer and I introduced, I think, the strongest legislation ever introduced to address the global warming crisis. And what our legislation does is address the reality in which scientists today are telling us that if we don't get our act together and cut greenhouse gas emissions, we are looking, and it could even be higher than this, but an 8-degree Fahrenheit increase in the Earth's temperature. And that is by the end of the century, Tom. And that is just unbelievable.
Well, if you look up the Permian extinction was caused in part by a 5-degree increase in temperature, which then melted the methane crystals, which added another 5 degrees. So it was a total of 10 degrees Celsius increase. And that extinction was the worst of the five. It killed off 95% of all life on Earth.
Well, you know, I hope we're not going to be killing off 95%
sure
of life
so
on
too.
Earth. But what we do know is if we don't get our act together, if the planet's temperature continues to rise, you're looking, and people have got to understand this. This is what scientists are now predicting. And some of them say that this 8 degrees Fahrenheit at the end of the century, that may be a conservative estimate. But what you're looking at is that great American cities like New Orleans, Boston, or Miami might be underwater. What you're looking at is that terrible hurricanes like Irene and Sandy, and we just spent $60 billion helping the people of New York and New Jersey deal with Sandy. These could be occurring more frequently and with more severity, a huge cost to the taxpayers of this country. If you see more drought in the United States and around the world, that means that the price of food is going to soar because there will not be the land available to grow crops that produce the food that we eat. You're looking at more wars and international instability because you're going to have populations all over the world fighting for limited water and land resources to get the water they need to drink and the food they need to stay alive. So we have got a real serious problem. What we do in this legislation is introduce a fee on carbon, and it only impacts the top 3,000 polluters in the country. We protect communities from fracking. We make very significant investments in energy efficiency and sustainable energy. As a nation, we waste a huge amount of energy. We try to deal with that issue, invest in wind, solar, geothermal, biomass. We're going to weatherize 1 million homes. We're going to pass trade legislation which says that companies that are not, that are continuing to pollute the planet cannot bring their products into this country without a significant tariff. We're going to have a major rebate program to help working families deal with any increased costs in fuel that they may incur.
Wow.
But the time is now to understand the severity of the climate change issue and to move aggressively to address it.
We'll be back with more Senator Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie, a day early here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, drop by Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. Great news source. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie hour, a day early. Senator Sanders with us today. He won't be around tomorrow for the show, so we're very, very pleased that he could make time to be with us today. And Senator, you want to pick up some calls, or did you want to add anything?
No, no. Let's do the calls.
Okay. Peter in Voorheesville, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you, Tom. And Senator Sanders, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. My question is, and I think I've got this right, and I wanted to run it by you. In 1965, LBJ signed Medicare and Medicaid, and it was passed in exchange for a drop on the tax on the rich from 91% to 74%. And if so, what are the poor getting today for their permanent tax, Bush tax breaks that are permanent now?
Okay. I don't know the history. I wish I did, Peter. What we have now are poor people, by and large, are not paying federal income tax. And the sensible reason for that is that real income for millions of low-income people has actually gone down in recent years. And we have almost as many people living in poverty today as we have had in the modern history of America, somewhere around 46 million. So you have in our country today, as I mentioned earlier, an incredibly unequal distribution of income and wealth, where currently all of the new income is going to the top 1%, where the top 1% earns more income than the bottom 50%. We have one family in this country, the Walton family, owning more wealth than the bottom 40% of the American people, where the gap between the very rich and everybody else is growing wider. That's the reality. One of the ways that we hope to address this, by the way, and the president, to his credit, mentioned this, is to raise the minimum wage. My own feeling is it should be higher than $9 an hour. I'd like to see it closer to 10. But bottom line is we have millions of people working 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week, struggling to take care of their families on very low wages, still living in poverty. That minimum wage has to go up.
James in Belvedere, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hey, it's an honor, as always. Yeah, I agree with like 110% of what you say, Bernie. I'm a huge fan. I would suggest, since we're a tax-based society, and I understand, you know, there's so many people that don't even qualify for the minimum tax, you know, which is a crime, basically. That's nothing to tout about. You know, 47% of people are don't even meet the minimum criteria of the tax structure. But we could use people that are paying into the federal income tax, that are fortunate enough to have a job, that are get up and go to and do that job. They're not retired yet. We're not indigent because we have other programs for that. They're not disabled.
James, your point?
In for a couple years. The point is, you can take that tax money, $2,000 to $3,000, give it back to the homeowner and to buy ecological energy efficient furnaces, water heaters, and make the manufacturing base, windows, insulation, make the manufacturing base be only qualified for products that are manufactured, produced, and sold retail in this country. So not only are you increasing your ecological advantages.
Got it. Let's get Bernie's thoughts on this, James.
James is absolutely right. What he is saying is that we should invest in weatherization. I know that in Vermont, we have probably led the country in terms of making our homes more energy efficient. We have a long way to go, and we're ahead of the rest of the country. So there are millions and millions of people out there who are now spending huge sums of money trying to heat their homes when their homes are very energy inefficient, poor insulation, poor windows, poor doors, poor roofing. We build those products in America. We have Americans installing those products, retrofitting those homes. You save money for consumers, cut their heating bill way down, create jobs in America, and perhaps most importantly, you significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions. This is a win-win-win situation. It is exactly what the legislation that I introduced today does.
Donette in Hinesville, Georgia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air, Donette. Donette? I heard you say hello. Okay. Bernie, Donette's question was, is there still a way to reform the filibuster? And I'm asking that because I'm curious, too.
Well, interestingly enough, I just came from, you know, as you know, I'm an independent and I caucus with the Democrats. There is a lot of angst that the Republicans, in an almost, not quite, but an almost unprecedented way, may be requiring a 60-vote margin for Chuck Hagel to be Secretary of Defense. And I tell you that the majority leader mentioned in the caucus, you know, we can rebuild, we can bring up once again that issue of the talking filibuster. I voted against the legislation that passed a few weeks ago because it didn't go far enough. At the end of the day, what I want to see is people who are in opposition should have all the time they need to speak. They want us to be on the floor for 24 hours, that's fine. Somebody else comes on, that's fine. But at the end of all of the speeches, we need a vote, and that vote should be majority rules. Majority rules. 51 votes wins. And that, in fact, can be introduced at any time. In fact, that issue just came up a few hours ago.
Yeah, and that rules change actually takes us back to what the Constitution says, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't the Constitution say a majority in both houses?
The Constitution does. What people will argue is the Constitution refers, makes mention of percentages to override a veto. You need
right.
two-thirds.
Right.
To do this, you may that. But there is certainly no mention in the Constitution about any 60-vote necessity.
So the filibuster.
So certainly, you could have 50 votes.
Right. So the filibuster is just it is the effect.
A rule passed by the Senate. That's
right.
All it is.
To govern itself. Yeah. Okay. We'll be back right after this break with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, our national town hall meeting. The guy I think of as America's senator, although Vermonters know and loved him as their own. Senator Bernie Sanders. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov, for more information on what Bernie's up to. In particular, this incredible piece of legislation that he and Barbara Boxer just proposed in the Senate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, you can drop by the Tom Hartman Program website, tomhartman.com. We have a new app where you can keep up on our daily stack, Sue's Daily Stack, every story we talk about. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. It's Brunch with Bernie. A day early. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. And Tom in Brooklyn, New York, listening on our New York affiliate, WWRL. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie.
Hey, Bernie? Tom. Yep. How are you?
Okay. I'm one of the striking school bus drivers that's trying to stop the race to the bottom. But with our Congress that voted for the Postal Service to fund its retirement 75 years in advance, I don't understand why Social Security doesn't follow suit and just take the cap off of Social Security taxing and just have Social Security secure for infinitum.
Tom, I agree with you. And as a matter of fact, I have introduced legislation along with Congressman Peter DeFazio to do just that. What that legislation does, in fact, it says that right now, as you know, Tom, if one person makes $1 million a year and another person makes $113,000 a year, they both pay the same amount into the Social Security Trust Fund because of the cap on taxable income. If you lift that cap, and you don't have to start at $114,000, you can create a bubble and then begin at $250,000. So the only people paying more into the Social Security Trust Fund are people earning more than $250,000. If you do just that, Social Security will be solvent for the next 75 years. Right now, Social Security can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 21 years, has a $2.7 trillion surplus. But obviously, we have to do better. We have to make Social Security solvent for a lot longer period of time, and that is exactly, in my view, the way to do it.
Vera in San Diego, California, watching Free Speech TV. Vera, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, and thank you very much for both of you for everything you do. Really appreciate it. My concern is that in the State of the Union address that President Obama again brought up a TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has the provisions that could lower our environmental standards here and further contribute to climate change. the politics of it. They want to fast track it. My question to Bernie is, do we have a chance to stop this or drastically amend it so that the more onerous provisions on our country, will not take place?
Well, Vera, I agree with your concerns absolutely. I don't recall having ever voted for any of these trade agreements, which is NAFTA, or permanent normal trade relations with China. I think the end result of these trade agreements has been to allow companies in this country to shut down factories here, move to low-wage countries, and cost us a whole lot of decent-paying jobs. And I share that concern with this trade agreement. Actually, later this afternoon, I'll be meeting with one of the leading trade activists to talk about this issue. But we will do everything we can to see that this trade agreement is as non-onerous as we can make it, and that's what we'll try to do.
Kevin, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Kevin, listening on Sirius? That's interesting. That's two callers. I wonder if we have a problem with one of our phone lines. Ken in Geneva, Illinois. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, glad to talk to both of you. I was wondering about the amendments to the Constitution, and somebody said, oh, well, you can't amend anything in the Bill of Rights. And I didn't believe that, and I can't find it. There was only three amendments that you're not supposed to touch in the Bill of Rights, but the Second Amendment is not one of them. And is that true?
No, I don't think it is true, Ken. I think, the people of this country and the Congress of this country, in a sense, can do anything that they want. They can repeal constitutional amendments. They could add new constitutional amendments. They could rewrite constitutional amendments. So I think, we are a democracy and people have the right to do whatever we think makes sense.
Yeah, a great example of that is repealing prohibition. It was put in place by a constitutional amendment. It was taken out by a constitutional amendment. Carol, in Apache Junction, Arizona, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you so much for the work you're going to do on climate change. As an environmentalist, that's really one of my most important issues. This time I was calling on something a little more personal. I don't know if you've heard from any of your constituents or not, but Medicare, for some reason, has moved some drugs, one that I take, Nexium, into something they call a step therapy program. And instead of getting a 90-day supply and three renewals, now my doctor has to call in every time. I only get a 30-day supply, and they've also upped the copay. Have you heard anything about this? There's no good reason that they should do that to something like Nexium. It's not a narcotic.
Carol, I apologize. I do not know the answer to your question. The issue that we are working on, which is a broader issue, obviously, that goes beyond your own personal concern there, is that right now Medicare is unable to negotiate prescription drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry because of a provision placed in there by the Republicans in the Medicare Part D prescription drug program. So that's a broader issue that we're trying to work on. We think we can save substantial sums of money for Medicare and for taxpayers, but I have to plead ignorance to the particular issue that you raised.
Dan in Valley Cottage, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
How you doing, Senator? I'm a huge admirer of yours, and I wanted to thank you for your service to the country. Second, I wanted to ask you, regarding feed-in tariffs for solar power that they use in Germany, and the success that they've had there and the huge popularity that they've had there in making profitable businesses out of, individual homeowners who just have extra solar power now to sell it back to the grid. Is there any way that you could convince Republicans, if they're capitalists, the true capitalists, if they could be convinced that to show them the numbers and show them that feed-in tariffs work, it becomes very successful businesses, it could thrive all over the country because we have so much more sun than they do in Germany, and that you can make really profitable businesses out of the entire Midwest, the West Coast, down in Florida. It could be a huge opportunity. I'm just not sure why we don't do that in the United States to explode solar power and make it the resource that we
need. Dan, thank you. That's an excellent question. Nothing I can add to it. I think your point is exactly right. Now, here's the good news. and I think the president made mention of this during his speech. We are making, you know, people may not know it. We have made in the last 3 or 4 years significant progress in sustainable energy, wind and solar, among others. The price of solar panels has plummeted. What Dan is suggesting is that through a feed-in tariff, you can encourage more people to install solar panels. The more people who are using solar panels, everything being equal, the lower the price will be because companies will be producing even more. We will be saving money on our fuel bills. We'll be creating jobs in America. We'll be cutting greenhouse gas emissions. It is, in my view, exactly what we should be doing.
Roger in Hockley, Texas, watching on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I was wondering if the president, through executive order, declare a war on climate change and fund, say, through the Defense Department, a jobs program to build a smart grid, build and install solar and wind systems on every house in the Sun Belt, or starting in the Sun Belt and moving out from there, at no charge to the residents, and then tax carbon, all carbon, to pay for this, get rid of the unemployment for any healthy, physically fit persons, and you have zero unemployment, or it would be a potential to have zero unemployment.
Well, let me say this, Roger. The president, in his State of the Union address, did mention the fact that he wanted to see legislation passed. Ultimately, legislation is the most effective way to deal with these problems in a comprehensive approach. The legislation that Senator Barbara Boxer and I have introduced would, I think, address many of the issues you have just raised, and that is the way to go. If we cannot get legislation through, the president himself, through executive order, does have a certain amount of power, and certainly the Environmental Protection Agency does have a certain amount of power in terms of enforcing the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and stopping carbon pollution. So if we can't get good legislation passed, then we want to see the president act to the degree that he can, and we want to see the EPA act. But long term, if we are serious about cutting carbon pollution, if we're serious about reversing global warming, if we're serious about creating the millions of jobs we can create by transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel, then we need comprehensive legislation to do that. And that is exactly what Senator Boxer and I are working on.
Bernie, we have just 30 seconds or so. The legislation that you as Senator Boxer introduced today, are you looking for more co-sponsors?
We sure are. And if the listeners out there, we just dropped the bill today, so I don't even think we have a number on it. But if listeners want to call up their senators or members of the House and say that they want to get on board this legislation, that would be terrific. It's the Sanders-Boxer environmental bill just dropped today.
Great. The Sanders-Boxer environmental bills just dropped today, and you can call both your senators and your member of the House of Representatives. If you go to callcongress.org, you'll find toll-free numbers as well as the main switchboard number for Congress.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour a day early here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour a day early. Senator Sanders taking your calls. Rick in Alberta, Canada. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Tom. Senator, good work on the legislation, and it's often said the U.S. has to lead in certain things. In this case, I'm glad to see this because our Prime Minister, Harper, neocon, of course, but his biggest excuse has always been, his excuse for doing nothing on climate change has been, oh, we have to wait to see what the U.S. is going to do. So hopefully we take that excuse away.
Well, thank you, Rick. You're right. The United States is the wealthiest, most powerful nation on earth. We should lead. We can lead. And if the United States does the right thing, I hope that Canada will follow us, and in fact that the rest of the world will follow us. And the bottom line here is that I personally believe, that when you are aggressive in cutting greenhouse gas emissions, and when we are aggressive in saving the planet from all of the destruction which we are looking at, it makes absolutely good economic sense to transform our energy system. And when we do that, we not only prevent destruction, but we also create a whole lot of jobs moving to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. So, Rick, we look forward to Canada following us.
Mark in New York City, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Senator Sanders, I just want to wish you a very happy Valentine's Day. You too, Tom.
Thank you.
My question is, with the transaction tax and the problems that we're going to have getting Congress passing any kind of tax, couldn't the executive office instruct the Commerce Department to put some kind of a fee on these transactions, as they are interstate commerce, aren't they?
I think probably not. I think the law is pretty clear that the concept of a transaction tax, I suspect you're talking on stock transfers, is something that Congress is going to have to do. It's something that I would like to see done for a couple of reasons. Number one, it is a way to raise significant revenue in a fairly progressive way. You can structure it so that it only applies to the stock brokerage firms and upper-income people. And number two, it will also put a damper on a lot of the speculation which currently takes place in Wall Street, which, in fact, has driven us into the recession that we're in right now. So I'm a strong supporter of a transaction tax on stocks, but it cannot be done unilaterally by the White House.
John in Santa Rosa, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon to you both. I have a question as regards the problems of the Postal Service. I just need some historical information. As we know, a large part of what's happening with them was the result of an onerous requirement placed on them by a lame duck session of Congress in 06. I'm just wondering why, in the beginning of 09, when the Democrats controlled both the White House and both chambers of commerce, Congress, why wasn't the Postal Service fixed then? Because presumably you could have gotten legislation out of the House of Representatives then. And I don't claim to be an expert on Senate rules, but I'm thinking, because it's budgetary, maybe you could have gotten it out of the Senate through this budget reconciliation process.
John, that is a very fair question, and I can't give you the answer to it. All that I can tell you is that last year, having been informed by the postal unions and people throughout the state of Vermont about what was going on, I kind of jumped into the issue. We put together a coalition. We passed a reasonably good bill in the Senate, bipartisan, which, among other things, would have done away with this onerous funding of pre-health retirement benefits of retirement benefits for postal workers, retirees. And right now we're continuing that effort. We have just the other day introduced really strong legislation to address the postal crisis, and we're going to stay focused on it. But I can't tell you why it wasn't moved on in 2009.
Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, I was wondering why no one has introduced as legislation a bill that would convert our power grid to superconductive plastic. That would eliminate the need to produce 40% of our power.
Steve, you're over my head in physics on that one. I just don't know the answer to it. I'm sorry.
Gabriel in La Mesa, California. We have 2 minutes until the end of the hour. Gabriel, quick one for Bernie.
Yeah, my question is that I read somewhere in a public opinion poll about climate, the greenhouse gases and the climate changes, that most Americans just think that it's something that should be on the back burner. It's something they're concerned about, but it's something that maybe in 10 years they should be worried about. And I was kind of surprised at that. I thought that they would be more worried about it. Is that still something that you find today where a lot of Americans are concerned about it, but not a pressing issue?
Well, here's what I think happened. Gabriel. I think it happened in the United States, and it's happened around the world. And you have to appreciate that in opposition to us are huge amounts of money coming into the process from the fossil fuel industry, from the coal companies, from the oil companies, who are funding organizations, funding media, which is trying to suggest to people that we're not really quite sure about the causes of climate change, et cetera, et cetera. So we got real powerful opposition there. I think a number of years ago, people were very concerned. I think the right wing and the fossil fuel industry poured a lot of money in it to confuse people. I think the support for change went down. But you know what's happened? In recent years, people have observed, not by watching TV and hearing pundits, but with their own eyes, exactly what is happening. If you're living in the Southwest, you're seeing unprecedented drought. You're seeing forest fires. If you're living in the Northeast, you went through Hurricane Sandy, went through Hurricane Irene. All over the, if you used to ice fish in Minnesota, you're suddenly finding that those lakes aren't freezing anymore. And people are beginning to catch on. Something real is happening, which has devastating impact on the world today and in the future. So, Gabriel, I think what we are seeing now is more and more people are looking out in the world.
Thank you, Bernie.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Secession, civil war, watering the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots. Interesting literature being passed out at a recent NRA convention calling for secession and civil war, if I'm reading this right. It was an article that was titled, What Would Davy Crockett Say? It was written by Paul Koenigs. I used to live in Germany. The German pronunciation would be Koenigs, but K-O-E-N-I-G-S. Carl Koenigs. And Carl is with us. He writes for Reality News Media. He's also the state coordinator for GiveMeLiberty.org and the Wisconsin Tea Party Committee's Coalition on State Sovereignty. Hey, Paul. Hey, Carl. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good afternoon, Tom.
So did you really mean that it's time to water the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots? In other words, it's time to kill federal officials?
No, absolutely not. That particular article, in fact, really means just the opposite, in that with everything going the way it is with our huge public debt that we have right now, which is over $16.5 trillion, and the unfunded liabilities of Social Security, Medicare, and the Medicare prescription drug program being cumulatively $122 trillion, which is increasing at the rate of $1 trillion every month. Our feeling is that our elected representatives, Republicans and Democrats, sooner or later will actually want us to pay for that. And we believe that they're going to have to come after the middle-class taxpayers, because that's where the money is available to be able to pay.
I thought the middle class taxpayers were pretty much wiped out. Most people are underwater in their homes. We've got over $1 trillion in student loan debt. There's over $1 trillion in credit card debt. The top 1% in this report just came out yesterday for 2009, 2010, 2011, over 100% of all income gains were only in the top 1%. Everybody in the bottom 99% actually saw 0.4% decrease in income. Net wealth, the bottom 99% since 2007, has lost, $7 trillion in net wealth, most of that in housing values. So, I mean, we're tapped out, Carl. I mean, if you believe your numbers, And you know, we could have a debate about them, but I really don't see any point in it. You believe those numbers to be the case. What are they going to take?
Right. Our committee, our Wisconsin Tea Party Committee on State Sovereignty, we absolutely agree with what you're talking about there, Thumb. And I'd also like to augment that with saying that there was a research done that wanted to find out if you would take all of the money, all the assets, all the companies, and everything that the 1% had. In fact, actually the top 10% had. All that money would only last 347 days of the year just to pay for the thousands of USER patients that exceed the 18 enumerated powers clauses of Article 1, Section 8.
Well, again, Carl, you know, we could dispute those numbers. And you know, when you consider that one family, the Walton family, has wealth that is greater than that of 40% of America, that the 400 richest Americans have more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans, we can get into that kind of minutia, but and debate it if you want. But I'm willing to say you believe your numbers. I think they're wrong, but you believe your numbers. And so my question to you is, what, you know, you're calling for a civil war. I mean, here I've got the article here right in front of me. You said, or otherwise by, this is if our federal public servants, well, in fact, here, this is the most heinous disease that can only be cured by the constitutional decentralized power of our home country of Wisconsin, restoring our supreme laws, in quotes, on our federal public servants within our borders. In other words, you can tell me what that means. Or otherwise by a combo civil slash re-revolutionary war with the very same goal to restore the rule of our laws on our elected, non-elected, and wannabe elected Republican and Democrat, I'm assuming you meant Democratic, federal servants through the refreshment of the Tree of Liberty by its natural manure, which, of course, Thomas Jefferson said was blood. What are you suggesting? I get it that you're diagnosing a problem, and I don't disagree with you that there is a problem. We can disagree on the nature and size of the problem, but or even how to solve the problem. But I don't understand what your specific solution is when you write that you're calling for a civil war or a revolutionary war, and then you say that you're not. What's the middle ground here?
Yeah, the point of that is that we're going to end up in a situation where the federal government, our elected servants, have no choice but to tax all of the middle class and basically take virtually the greatest percentage of our gross income.
The banksters have already taken it all. Again, I mean, we're back to this thing.
So my point is that we're going to end up with our choice that we can either use our constitutionally protected power of nullification to nullify the power, size, scope, and spending of the federal government from our states.
How do you do that?
Which formed our federal government under something called the Great Connecticut Compromise.
No, but you're thinking of the Articles of Confederation. The power of nullification was within the Articles of Confederation. That was rejected in 17. I mean, we operated under those rules from 1783 when we won the Revolutionary War until 1787 when the Constitution was ratified. But the Constitution, you know, we're no longer a loose collection of 13 sovereign states that basically have, instead of a constitution, a giant trade agreement. We now have a federal constitution that places the federal government sovereign above the individual states, and it's unambiguous. Are you suggesting overthrowing the government of the United States?
No, I am not. But let's go back in time just a little bit, Thumb, because I don't believe that your historical record is correct. What had happened was James Madison and the Federalists wanted to completely dissolve the states and just have one federal government.
They absolutely did not. James Madison was a Virginian, and he was very dedicated to his state of Virginia. Read the debates in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, Carl. I think you'll be fascinated by them.
Yeah. Let me just finish with what I'm saying here, though.
Sure.
The states were refusing to ratify the Constitution, and they're having a tremendous debate and argument.
Virginia's principal objection from Mason and Patrick Henry was that they were concerned that it would end slavery.
Is something called the Great Connecticut Compromise, which allowed the states to form a more perfect union of free and independent states.
Right.
Giving only 18 enumerated powers to the federal government to handle those powers and those things only, and only being able to spend money on those 18 enumerated things. That is the history of the Great Connecticut Compromise that made the Constitution even possible, and even the federal government itself possible.
Where in the Constitution does the phrase enumerated powers appear?
Of Confederation right now, as a matter of fact.
Where in the Constitution does the phrase enumerated powers appear?
In the preamble of the Constitution, you'll see that we the people, in order to form a more perfect union,
right.
What they're talking about there is a more perfect union of free and sovereign states, which was necessary.
No, it doesn't say that. It says a more perfect union, period.
Ratified.
This is the nation. And when you read what is generally referred to as the enumerated powers part of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, you know, it gives absolutely totally broad power to Congress to do anything it wants that's going to promote the general welfare, to raise taxes and spend money.
That's not correct either. The general welfare phrase of which you're speaking of, which is also listed under...
Carl, we have to take a break. Can you stick around?
By all means.
Hang on. This is just going to take a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're talking with Carl Koenigs. He's with the Wisconsin Tea Party Committee Coalition on State Sovereignty and GiveMeLiberty.org. Okay, so Paul Koenigs is with us. He's a state coordinator with the Wisconsin Tea Party and the Wisconsin Tea Party Committee Coalition on State Sovereignty. He's the state coordinator with GiveMeLiberty.org. Writes for Reality News Media. Is the author of this piece, What Would Davy Crockett Say? That explicitly calls for a combo civil/re-revolutionary war to restore the rule of our laws. And Paul, I'm sorry, I keep calling you Paul, and I don't know why. You've been talking about the Connecticut Compromise. We've been talking about the history of the Constitution, you know, what led to why there are two senators from each state, rather than being based on population, the Three-Fifths Compromise that came out of the Connecticut Compromise and the Virginia Plan and all that stuff. But the bottom line for all this, I still am not hearing from you how, short of a genuine reenactment of the Civil War, a genuine secession from the Union, taking up arms against the federal government, as you write, you know, watering the tree of liberty with his natural manure, what Thomas Jefferson called the blood of patriots. Short of that, how you intend to say to the federal government, no, we're not going to respect those laws. I mean, you got California pot farmers who are trying to say that, and they're getting thrown in jail.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we are proposing, Tom, is to produce state legislation that will, first of all, produce our sponsor and pass our alternate state joint sovereignty resolution with the rest provision.
But your Wisconsin state constitution says that the state is subordinate to the federal government.
The 10th Amendment states that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
Right.
What we are proposing is that we solidify the 10th Amendment, and that any powers that were not delegated to the United States by the Constitution will simply be nullified.
But wait, hang on just a second here. You're saying that if the federal government has overreached, that you want Wisconsin to be able to nullify that, has constitutionally overreached. But Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution explicitly, where the powers granted to Congress. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now, you and I can disagree on what general welfare of the United States means, but the Supreme Court has long ago said, in fact, three generations ago said, that Social Security is included in the general welfare of the United States, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's, to the best of my knowledge, no genuine dispute at the federal level about whether these things, these programs that you don't like, are constitutional. And so if there's no constitutional overreach, the mechanism that we have for remedying constitutional overreach is taking it to the Supreme Court.
The meaning of the term general welfare was penned by the founding fathers in the Federalist Papers. Like I said, you can view Federalist 33, you can view Federalist 78. There's a couple other Federalist articles that also pertain to the meaning of some of these terms, general welfare.
And Hamilton and, points out that they, and, that they wrote them it, to mean well, as, you know, as broad the, as cons- as possible so as not to constrain future generations. It is in Federalist 78, and I recommend people read it, that, that they made that general welfare clause as broad as possible so future Congresses could deal with contingencies, was the phrase, I believe, that Hamilton. It's been a while since I read it.
If you read that, what it states... is that anything that exceeds the powers enumerated in the Constitution should be considered as usurpation and be
right. But you and I both know that the Federalist Papers were a sales pitch for the Constitution. They're not part of the law of our land. The Constitution
no, but they
is
do
the law of our land.
The meaning of the Constitution.
And well, and then how do you reconcile that with?
I am not saying that the. Certainly not the Warren Commission, most especially, but I am not stating that the, and I'm not arguing that the Supreme Court has been right in all of its interpretation.
You meant the Warren Court.
As a matter of fact, the Warren Court, certainly had interpreted many things wrong.
Sure, Brown v. Board of Education. That was the thing that got Fred Koch's dad all cranked up and got billboards all across the United States that said impeach Earl Warren was, you know, how dare he force school segregation or force school desegregation. But still, I'm not trying to play word games here with you, Carl. I'm genuinely trying to understand. If I was a citizen, I live in the District of Columbia, so I don't have a state, but if I lived in the state of Wisconsin, as you do, what mechanism other than pointing to the Federalist Papers or the Connecticut Compromise? I mean, I don't understand how you're going to legally pull this off, and I also don't understand why you would talk about a civil war and revolutionary war and spilling the blood of patriots if you don't actually mean that. I don't get it.
Okay, my point to that is in order for, if people start getting charged for the taxes, and I'm talking about the middle class now, that has to be paid to pay for over $16.5 trillion in public.
Respectfully, Carl, you're being hysterical about something that there's no reason to be hysterical about.
Unfunded liabilities, which they're going to come after us sooner or later.
No, they're not.
We would unless we were willing to be vassalage here in the great United States.
Carl, after World War II, we had more debt than we have now. We were at 127% of GDP, our debt, after World War II. We're in the neighborhood of 100% right now.
We spent
our way out of it. Eisenhower built a national highway system.
You are not including the $122 trillion in unfunded liabilities.
If you do away with the cap on Social Security, so people making over $113,000 are paying the same amount, so Bill Gates pays the same amount in Social Security that you and I do, Carl, Social Security and Medicare are solvent forever. This is something that the billionaires sit around worrying about, but I don't get it. Well, now I'm ranting and I'm running out of time here, and I wanted you to have the last word. There's no time. Carl Koenigs, am I saying it right, Carl?
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us. Hang on just a second. I'll give you
your
website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Carl's article is What Would Davy Crockett Say? It's published by the Reality News Media, and you can his website, givemeliberty.org. Thanks again, Carl. Welcome back, Tom. I've been here with you 34 minutes past the hour. I still, Carl is not here to defend himself. I don't want to pick on him or call him names or anything like that. I genuinely believe that folks like Carl genuinely believe what they're saying. There's no doubt in my mind that this guy was totally sincere. He's scared to death that there's $100 trillion in unfunded mandates out there that are going to get us. And, which is like, I just want to say chill out. And, And he's genuinely certain that if we don't do something about it now, which means, you know, kill off the federal government or pieces of it, large chunks of it, like Social Security and Medicare, hand that stuff off to Wall Street, that there's going to be a disaster. And this is the kind of hysteria which is created by people like Pete Peterson or the Koch brothers. I mean, these billionaires who either because of ideological reasons, I think in the case of David Koch, you know, one of them actually ran for president on the Libertarian ticket back in the 70s or 80s. Whether it's ideological or whether in the case of Pete Peterson, I think it's, you know, he's a Wall Street billionaire. He wants to, there's $2.7 trillion sitting in the Social Security Trust Fund. Can you imagine what a guy on Wall Street could make out of that? I mean, talk about churn rate. So, you know, I get it that kind of hysterical, frankly, and paranoid somewhat PR or lack of propaganda is probably the word that's been promoted by the billionaires, particularly the Wall Street billionaires, has got a lot of average working people freaked out. And those people are coming together into this thing that they call the Tea Party. But then they start talking and you know, what's being fed to them is, well, look at the Connecticut Compromise and, you know, or the Virginia, you know, and it's like, you know, I'm familiar with the process that led to the Constitution of the United States. In fact, Alexander Hamilton, in his, I refer you to his letter to Congress in 1793, his report on manufactures, in which he talked about, you know, Congress has this incredible power under the General Welfare Clause, and they should use it to place tariffs on imported goods and to subsidize the manufacture of you know, things that are critical to the strength of the United States. I'm paraphrasing wildly here, but you can read it yourself. I mean, he says it in the language of the 18th century. But it's there. So, and it's as much a part of the historical record as anything else, but I don't get what their solution is other than being frightened. And I think that's, you know, frightened or angry. And I think it's really sad. And I think it's really unfortunate when that gets turned into things like Republican politicians saying, I'm a Tea Partier, damn it. I'm in favor of small government. But by the way, I'd like to run for office. What? Really? Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi. I think you needed the Twilight Zone in the last segment.
Well, the thing is that Carl's perspective is shared by probably, certainly hundreds of thousands and maybe even millions of Americans.
Let me recommend them a book written in 1999 by Gary Wills, G-A-R-R-Y, Wills. It's called A Necessary Evil. And I'm looking at the passage right now on page 60 that explains that the states did not exist prior to the Constitution. The Declaration of
Independence. Wait a minute. They did exist as many of them. I mean, Vermont was a sovereign nation, and so others of them had individual constitutions.
They weren't organized under the Constitution.
No, but they were organized as states or as commonwealths.
I believe only one was.
Okay.
And in many of the House of Delegates in these territories hadn't even really formed up at that point. And the Constitution was written because of the Articles of Confederation and the House of Burgesses were absolute failures.
Yeah.
What scares me is anybody thinks that the legislature of Illinois or Wisconsin or Michigan is better than the federal government at doing these things, doing what the federal government does, is ludicrous, because you can only look at every single state, practically,
right,
and see how badly they function. So I don't know what they're quite getting at. And the point that Gary Wills makes in the book, if I can remember, it's complicated, but that there's only one sovereign. It's the federal government. You can't have 10 of them.
Right.
Or 50 of them.
Right. And this was the problem that we had under the Articles of Confederation, is that we had 13 sovereign governments, and the Articles of Confederation did not create a federal union. What they were basically was a trade a free trade agreement. They were, or not a, even a free trade agreement, but what would be sold today as a free trade agreement. The federal government principally regulated trade among the states. And that was pretty much it.
And they only looked at it for their own interests, which
right.
is why there's the Congress.
And it didn't work.
I mean,
it's why we had three presidents before George Washington. Nobody remembers their names.
We did.
We did. There were three people who were elected president by the Continental Congress who preceded George Washington. George Washington was the first president after the ratification of the Constitution when the United States of America, as we know it, as a modern federal republic, a constitutionally limited democratic republic, came into being. And so in any case, Richard, thank you for sharing that with me. I want to let some other folks, you know, get their voices in here. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. To comment on your conversation with Carl, now you may not want to beat up on him when he's not here, but he had his segments and he had his time, and so I have my segment, and I'm going to beat up on him a little bit.
Well, why don't you beat up on his idea?
Okay, fine. That's what I meant. I don't beat up on people. I beat up on his ideas. It reminded me a little bit of Marco Rubio because it sounded like he'd never read any of the things that he cited. Certainly his take on the what he called the Great Connecticut Compromise, which I've never heard it referred to that way, you corrected him that it was about how states were to be given senators to represent the small states so that there was some equality in that. But he went to – he pointed out in – he says Federalist Paper 33 – he was referring to the sovereignty of states. Well, the Federalist Papers 29 through 36, Publius writes, under the hand of Alexander Hamilton, all have to do with the general powers of taxation of the federal government, as described in Article 1 of the Constitution. They have nothing to do with so this comes down to where I think a lot of these people are simply not or ignorant or not knowledgeable of what they're citing. I think somebody probably told him this, and that's so he's repeating it. But and then the, as to the powers of the government, I want to give this analogy. Because the federal government has enumerated powers, to me that means these are things the government must do. Doesn't mean they can't do anything else. It just means that those are things. And as for things that the government may not do, those are just so the things that must do and things that may not do. It doesn't prohibit the government. Think of it this way.
And everything in between is allowed.
Exactly.
And the natural restraint or constraint on everything in between is, to quote Thomas Jefferson, the people themselves. In other words, our ability to have literally a revolution every 2 years in this country where we can throw out 100% of the House of Representatives and one-third of the Senate, or every 4 years where we can throw out the president as well. We have that revolutionary ability in our country. We use it frequently. This is not rocket science.
And there's an infinite number of possibilities under which democracy can exist. And I'll give you my analogy. If you think of the plane, the XY axis, well, if you think of the axes as being the bounds of government,
right.
Look at the entire rest of the plane. It's essentially infinite. So yes, there are bounds, but within those boundaries, as you said, everything else, there's an infinite number of possibilities under which democracy can exist, and
that's
we
right.
can decide as people that what we want.
Right. I'm with you, Paul. Thank you very much. Devin wants to disagree with me. Hey, Devin. In White Lake, Michigan. Hey, Devin. What's up?
Well, actually, along with that, I just jumped in. I'm trying to turn in here. And I just lost my train of thought.
You said I'm looking at the Constitution wrong, is what you told Danielle.
Yeah. Well, the states created the federal government, and as far as the general welfare, that is the enumerated 18 powers. Because if
what 18 powers?
You have, was it the post office, post roads, raise and supply an army. Those type of things.
Hang on just a second. The very first one of those, if you're going through the stuff in Article 1, Section 8, and there are 18
right.
there
one,
are 18 subsections
eight,
to that. The
18.
Very first one says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises
rest?
Shall be uniform throughout the United States. So the question, what the hell does general welfare mean? That answer has been decided 100,000 times in the 240 years since
the rest of that article
the
is
party,
described
230.
The rest that article describes what the general welfare is. Because if you would have, the way you guys are looking at it, the Constitution never, ever would have been ratified. We still would be amending Articles of Confederation.
Read number 18. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution, the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof. You're right, Devin. There are no limits. And there is an absolute limit, and that limit is the people themselves, to quote Jefferson. Again, we have elections. Devin, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So the Tea Party, this Tea Party guy is saying, what is it, going to be revolution, or we're not reading the Constitution right? Where are we going to go with this? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in on the news of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat. You can give a goat to help a rescued slave, literally a slave. We're talking South Sudan here, and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. GoatsfortheOldGoat.com is the website. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, what's going on in the world today?
As we speak, and I don't think it's finished yet, so I think I'm still right in saying this. The Senate is voting on cloture on Chuck Hagel's nomination to be defense secretary. So this is a vote to decide. It's a procedural vote.
Right. It's a vote to end debate, which is
end debate.
Yeah. And the Republicans have decided to say that they're going to require 60 votes to end debate, which is a fancy way of saying they're filibustering this. And yet, the last I heard, they're denying that they're filibustering it, but they are insisting on 60 votes. I don't see how you can,
this is a filibuster.
Yeah, it's like saying the sun is up, but it's not daytime.
Yeah, this is a filibuster by any other name. Now, what's interesting is that Harry Reid seems to be acknowledging that he does not have 60 votes. Also, he was apparently asked earlier today to delay the cloture vote for 10 days. And after he was asked to do that, he shortly after that made the announcement that the vote would be at 4:15 Eastern today,
which was a half hour ago. So the vote is ongoing right now.
Right.
Now you're in the White House every single day. You know most of these members of Congress. You have your ear to the ground. Any possibility? I mean, it seems to me that this is Mitch McConnell basically going back on the deal he made with Harry Reid to prevent Harry Reid from dialing back, from going to the talking filibuster that Jeff Merkley was proposing. Any possibility that this bad faith by the Republicans is enough to cause Harry Reid to say, we're going to reconsider changing the Senate rules?
I think it's going to push him close. He's obviously very, very angry to have announced that he was having that vote today at 4:15. I mean, he's absolutely furious.
Well, or he's calling their bluff.
I don't think he thinks that they've got 60 votes. I don't know where all these Republicans are coming from.
Right.
They've only got two.
Yeah.
That they know of. I mean, they haven't even got Susan Collins of Maine.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Susan Collins just came out against Hagel, which just boggles my mind. She's supposed to be a Republican moderate. It sounds to me like Mitch.
She says she likes him, and she admires his military record, and she appreciates the time they served together.
But
she just doesn't agree with the things that he said, and she doesn't think he did well in the hearing.
Doesn't this really mean that Mitch McConnell's whipping his caucus into shape or into line?
I think that's part of it, but I also think a lot of people think he didn't do well, and I think a lot of people plan to oppose him anyway. And so I think it was always going to be a fairly close vote. And you've got this troika of, Kelly Ayotte, Lindsey Graham, and John McCain. And then you've got the outliers of Ted Cruz and Jim Inhofe, who are saying he's in bed and cozy with Iran and a traitor. And, well, I made that word up, but pretty close
when you
look at what Ted Cruz said.
Virtually implied that, yeah.
They had said that those three, the troika, had demanded that they hear from the White House as to what the president was doing the night of September the 11th on the Benghazi attack. The White House has now said what the president did and whether he spoke to the chief of Libya, the president, and it turns out he did not. In fact, he asked our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton to speak to him, and he spoke to him on September the 12th. And so they've answered that question, and that's now not sufficient. They want there's something else they want to know.
Right. Okay.
So I think this has all sent Harry Reid over the edge.
We'll see. We'll see how this plays out. What else is going on, Victoria?
Transocean.
Transocean, this is the company who had the oil rig that blew up down in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 men.
That's correct. Transocean Deepwater was found guilty by a federal judge today of violating the Federal Clean Water Act based on its role in causing the uncontrolled release of 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico after the drilling rig exploded and sank in April 2010. And it's going to be required to pay $400 million to settle the criminal charges, the second highest criminal payment in history, only topped by BP's $4 billion criminal payment.
Wow. And I, you know, what I don't get is why a corporation gets, you know, convicted of a crime and they don't get the equivalent of the death penalty or of being sent to jail. In other words, they don't get shut down. Why is this just a cost of doing business? Well, you don't have to answer that as a rhetorical question.
Yeah, I can't answer that. Yeah. It's
so,
beyond me.
Other news events, Victoria?
Senate Democrats have reached a sequester deal today. They've signaled broad support for roughly $110 billion budget package, evenly divided between new tax revenues and spending cuts to forestall the across-the-board sequester cuts due to take place on March the 1st. A lot of it would come from cuts from farm subsidies and future defense spending after 2015, but it would be one-to-one cuts and tax revenue.
What are the chances of that being brought to the floor of the House by John Boehner?
Well, it might get to the House, but I don't think it'll get to the floor. I don't think it'll get a vote, so zero.
Yeah. So this means, I mean, we're what, three, four weeks out here?
It means it's a bargaining chip for talks. Yeah, it means we're less than that. It's February the 14th. We're exactly 2 weeks, 2 weeks and a day away.
Wow.
And we've got President's Day recess next week. We've got 6 days for Congress to be in session.
6 legislative days. And
well, actually less than that because it's the end of the day now, so it's 5, really.
Yeah, yeah.
5 days.
How do you expect this is going to play out?
At this point, I'm starting to expect that the cuts are going to come into effect and then that the cavalry will ride in late.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So it'll be the way that we figured that letting the Bush tax cuts expire and all that kind of stuff happened at the end of the year so that the Republicans get to vote on what's not a tax increase but is a tax cut. There's going to be that little Texas two-step there.
It's looking like a Texas two-step, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Okay.
Yeah. And finally, Senate Environment and Public Works Chairman Barbara Boxer said today she plans to move a comprehensive climate bill through her committee and to the floor by this summer.
That is great. That is great. And Senator Sanders and Senator Boxer introduced two pieces of really significant climate legislation today. They dropped the bill today. I don't know that there's even a number attached to it. But Bernie was on our program for an hour earlier today talking about it. So I'm assuming that's what you're talking about. Victoria Jones, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I am honored to have in the studio with me Daryl Hannah, the actress and activist, and Michael Bruin, who is the executive director of the Sierra Club, and both of you just fresh in from getting arrested out in front of the White House. Welcome, first
Thank
of all. You. Daryl Hannah, arrested?
I know. I'm not really a professional activist, but I'm compelled to, you know, to do everything I can to get the word out because there's so much misinformation out there and you know, to do what I can to help, you know, protect our life support systems.
The issue here being the Keystone XL pipeline, which Michael, the Sierra Club and you, what's your position on this? What kind of damage could this thing be doing?
It's a boondoggle. So for folks who haven't been following this, the Keystone XL pipeline would take dirty oil, the dirtiest oil on the planet, down from the tar sands all the way through the U.S. Most of it would be exported. it's at least a third more carbon intensive than conventional oil. So from a common sense perspective, if we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, if we want to stabilize our climate, we shouldn't be investing in oil sources, period. Definitely shouldn't be investing in oil sources that make the problem much worse than conventional oil.
Right. And do you think that the White House was noticing what y'all were doing yesterday? Any feedback on this, Daryl Hannah?
It's kind of been a nonstop situation. I mean, there was obviously demonstrations in front of the White House where every day for 10 days, 120 people were arrested. And then
about Keystone XL.
Keystone XL. And then, of course, the southern leg of the Keystone XL is currently being put in, and there's been resistance all along the way. In fact, you just got that wonderful call from that woman in Oklahoma who right. is so inspiring when I hear stories like that, and she, you know, had
she changed herself
her first,
to a bulldozer.
Yeah, she changed herself to a bulldozer at 74, her first act of civil disobedience. Incredible. And I participated with an act of civil disobedience with a woman who was also a great grandmother, 89 years old, and her first act of civil disobedience as well in Texas. And those kinds of things. There was a young man in Oklahoma as well the other day who was a pastor who also chained himself to some equipment. So those kinds of grassroots actions, as well as these more symbolic actions up here in D.C., have been sending a strong message, I think.
Right. And Michael, are you? I mean, you, certainly you have to have your ear to the ground about the politics of all this.
Yeah.
Today, Bernie Sanders. In fact, he spent the first hour of our program on the air with us.
Excellent.
In large part, talking about this, him and Barbara Boxer just proposed this pretty sweeping climate change legislation.
Sure.
He thinks that the winds are changing, that the times are changing. What's your sense of it?
I know they are. Look, I came here. The Sierra Club is based out in San Francisco, but I came here in early November after the election and met with a number of members of Congress on the Hill. And you could tell that particularly that storm, in addition to the droughts, in addition to the wildfires, has prompted a lot of Democrats to want to fight a lot harder for climate change and is starting to change some perspectives of some Republicans.
Right.
I think the other key thing that often isn't noticed is that most of the clean energy installations in this country are in Republican districts. 81% of all of the wind that's installed in the United States is in Republican districts.
That's the red states that are just east of the Rocky Mountains.
That's right. So many of the people who were affected by the wildfires are in Republican districts. Many of the people who are affected by the droughts live in Republican districts, and many of the people who would benefit from clean energy. So the ideology that grips the Republican Party right now can't hold for too long. Maybe it can hold for another season. Maybe it can hold for another year. But the more that this happens, the more that clean energy comes online and climate change gets worse, the harder it's going to be for Republicans to hold on to the status quo.
Right. And Daryl Hannah, the activism sphere, as it were, I mean, this is more than just you yourself said, I'm not a professional activist.
Yeah.
This is something that has brought you into this. Are you finding that more and more people are stepping forward to say this is an issue that is worth getting arrested for? This is an issue that's worth speaking out for? And if so, why?
Well, so many people now have been affected by these extreme weather events and the droughts and the fires and stuff that it's really undeniable. And it's, I think, really the only thing that's kind of keeping people feeling so polarized about any of these issues is just misinformation. Just the simple fact that people still think that this Keystone Pipeline is about energy security or going to have an effect on our gas prices. You know, that kind of misinformation or even, you know, the promise of an exaggerated number of jobs, they don't really recognize the impacts that this will have on the climate and the further expansion of the tar sands projects and how destructive those projects are and how lethal they are to not just the systems where they exist, you know, the boreal forest in Canada, and now there's one planned for actually Utah.
Right.
You know, this misinformation has been very successful in getting people to think that their own pocketbook and their own job security might possibly be at stake if if it doesn't go through.
When in fact it's not.
And in fact, it has nothing to do with that.
In fact, it's the opposite of anything. I mean, the more destruction we have. Michael, Greg Palace has been writing about, we've had him on the program a number of times, but the Koch brothers have this refinery down in Texas.
Yeah.
Why bring this all the way down to Texas? It's not that it's being brought to Texas, it's that it's being brought to the ocean. Well, why bring it to the ocean? So we can export it. Last year, the number one export of the United States was no longer washing machines, televisions, or jeans. We don't even make any of those things here anymore for all practical purposes. The number one export of the United States was refined gasoline and diesel fuel.
Right.
So we get the waste from the refineries here in America. We get the cancers and asthmas. And we're selling this stuff to England and China and Brazil.
Right.
Is that really what's going on? Is this all about somebody, the refineries making a profit?
Right.
It's got nothing to do with we need gasoline for Michigan.
We get the pollution and the oil companies get the profit. And that's why this is such a boondoggle. And that's why civil disobedience actually makes sense. Civil disobedience, you know, the Sierra Club participated in it for the first time in our 120-year history yesterday.
Hmm.
And we did that because this is a project that is so wrong. We have to stand up for it. 100 years ago, women got arrested so that they could have the right to vote. A century later, that seems nuts that we would actually have to fight over whether women should vote. 50 years ago, people were getting arrested just so they could sit at the lunch counter as Americans, regardless of the color of their skin. Today, that seems nuts. It already seems nuts one day later that we should have to get arrested. We should have to go to jail simply to say that we don't need to invest in dirty energy projects when clean energy would do a better job.
Right. But Susan B. Anthony did, you know, show up and vote in 1874, as I recall, November of 1874, and get arrested and get that $35 fine or whatever it was. And
Martin Luther King got arrested 30 times before he was 39.
Wow. So. Yeah. You know, neither one of them lived to see the full fulfillment of the work that they were doing. This is much more, I don't want to say more urgent than civil rights or women's rights, but we're talking about the possible survival of the planet. I mean, I've seen people talking about Permian extinction types of playouts here. You know, 5 degrees Celsius might be enough to do soda pop with methane hydride crystals.
The oceans are 30% more acid than they were at the beginning of the industrial age, and that's because of the carbon that they're sequestering from the atmosphere.
Right.
And that's already going to affect the base of the food chain. I mean, the pteropods that are those calcifications that are the base of the food chain cannot form their body parts in that kind of those kinds of acidic conditions. So it's really a scary situation.
Yeah, it all starts with the oceans, and we're killing off life in the oceans. We're killing off life. For all things, 10 seconds.
But what makes the most tragic is that we have the solutions and they work.
Yeah.
And they're cheaper and cheaper every day. So we can solve this problem. We just need to work at it.
Yeah. Despair is not an option.
That's right.
Michael Bruin, Daryl Hannah, thank you very much for being with us. And the website, what website would you like to mention?
SierraClub.org. Register for the largest climate rally in U.S. history. Go to our website and show up on Sunday at the National
This
Hall.
Weekend. Yay. Here in Washington,
D.C.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And don't forget, this Sunday, right here in Washington, D.C., on the National Mall, be there and go to SierraClub.org for more information. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, yeah, be there or be square this weekend, this Sunday, on the National Mall. Lots and lots of people showing up for, you know, Forward on Climate. There we go. D.C. rally. No KXL is the hashtag, forwardonclimate.org, and, of course, SierraClub.org. We've been talking about a lot of various things today. The Keystone XL pipeline, I suppose, is self-explanatory. The nature and state of the Tea Party and their belief that we're not a federal republic is a whole nother interesting thing. Wayne in New Baltimore, Michigan. Wayne, you wanted to weigh in on this.
Yeah, Mr. Hartman, every time I hear, like, the Tea Party and they espouse their ideology, they always wax nostalgic about the foundation of our country and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep talking about, like, a second, and don't get me wrong, I really appreciate, you know, everything you say about the founding fathers and what this Constitution really means. But they always forget about the Revolution. The revolution they're talking about occurred 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I never hear anybody talking about the American Civil War.
It's a little inconvenience maybe to history for some of these folks, but those 4 years established the federal system we have today. Nullification of John C. Calhoun went down the pike, and the states' right argument went down the pike. They lost, pure and simple.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say. But I hear these arguments.
No, I'm with you, Wayne. We litigated this, and 600,000, as I recall, people died. And it was the bloodiest war in the history of the United States in terms of per capita deaths, and maybe in terms of absolute deaths in a single war, and American deaths. And yes, we litigated whether states have the right to secede from the union and whether or not they have the right to nullify federal laws. And the end of that litigation was, as you correctly point out, that we are a federal republic. And you know, arguably always were, but we certainly flipped from a weak state, strong federal government to a strong federal government, weak state way of doing business as a consequence of the Civil War. You're absolutely right. Wayne, thank you for the call. And we codified that with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. Ziggy in Issaquah, Washington. Hey, Ziggy, what's up?
Hey, I just got a quick question. First, thank you, Tom, you and your wife and your staff. You're great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious in this talk with on the right, they're always talking rules, regulation, taxes. We can't pay minimum wage. It's going to affect, the hiring and this and that one.
Right.
It seems to me the fact of the matter is that if you got a small business or a little chain store or something, the conversation, the fight back from the left, how come you never hear them talk about the cost of their rent when they're paying $5,000, $9,000, $10,000 a month for their building rent? And then that leads into why is it so important to get housing costs so inflated or skyrocketing? And it pushes out a huge group of people to even become homeowners. But more than that, it affects small business. But you never hear that fight back, and it seems like that would be a
The reason why, Ziggy, is because there's not a large constituency left in the United States of small businesses. I mean, there's a fair number of them, but they're not well organized and they don't have a lot of resources. And the Reagan Revolution, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and we had this wave of mergers and acquisitions that has left us with $38 trillion in debt in the private sector and virtually every sector of our commercial economy dominated by between two and five major corporations. I'm not talking about sector corporate, individual companies. That, the small businesses have been largely put out of business. You don't walk into a mall and see 100 small businesses and one big chain store. It's the other way around, which is the opposite of before Reagan. Go ahead.
It seems like everything's a strip mall anywhere. My choices, they say people want you to buy American. I try to do that, but it's almost impossible. There is, as Kroger gets bigger or the Home Depot gets bigger, our choices and options of things have disappeared.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And these guys are ranting and yelling about liberty. And, how about the liberty of competition in a free marketplace, enterprise marketplace? No, it by and large doesn't, as a consequence of 32 years of Reaganomics. Ziggy, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Ian, in Youngstown, Ohio. Hey, Ian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It seems like the vast majority of economists agree that the drivers of our economy are the lower and the middle class. Paul Krugman certainly has written a ton about that.
Yeah.
Every credible
economist agrees with that. Even the supply side guys will acknowledge that demand plays a large role in an economy. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. It seems like, my question is, are people that support austerity measures oligarchs in that they know what they're doing? It seems like the rich would benefit. They're owning the businesses and to give, anything that fuels lower middle class growth, it seems like the upper echelon would benefit from that. But to me, it seems like it's not just their bottom line that they're concerned about. They're concerned about the difference between their bottom line and the lower middle class's bottom line, so they concentrate power.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And yeah, by and large, the people calling for austerity, and thank you for the call, Ian, are not so much they're the oligarchs, although certainly there are oligarchs who are calling for austerity, billionaires. But they basically hire frontmen and women to be their shills for this, whether they're politicians or whether they're these so-called think tanks or whether they're, you know, the talking heads on radio and TV, whatever it may be. And you're right. Austerity is, you know, it's another method to transfer wealth from the middle class to the very, very rich. And, you know, so just only 10 seconds. Okay. Well, we'll have to continue the conversation in just a few minutes. But I think, you know, point made, and austerity, the important point to remember about austerity is no country in the history of the world has ever cut its way to prosperity. It doesn't work that way. And, you know, we have been in debt before, much larger than the debt we have right now, although arguably we've never seen corporate debt like this, at least not since 1929. And the level of private sector debt is something, and Steve Keen was talking about on our program yesterday, something that we really have to concern ourselves with. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop by our website at tomhartman.com, participate in our live free chat room, hang out with some of the finest minds on earth. Hey, chat room folks. The bad and the very, very clodocantonously ugly, the good. Forward on climate. This Sunday, our nation's capital will play host to the largest climate rally in U.S. history. Forward on Climate will bring together more than 130 climate change organizations, as well as thousands of environmental activists and just ordinary American citizens who care about the future of our environment and our planet. The rally will take place on the National Mall, begin at the Washington Monument. Featured speakers will include Bill McKibben, Van Jones, and the Reverend Lennox Yearwood. With thousands of climate change activists pounding the streets of our nation's capital in the shadows of Congress, it will be near impossible to ignore the message of the rally. Excuse me, the climate change is very real. It's here to stay, and we need to take action now. Let's hope this rally ushers in a new campaign to save our planet. The bad. Lori Higgins. Higgins from the anti-gay hate group the Illinois Family Institute recently published a rant in which she argued that gays should not be hired as teachers nor be allowed to influence the minds of our children. In the rant, Higgins wrote that, quote, these teachers will put photos of their homosexual spouses on their desks and talk about their homosexual spouses to their students. Although schools are unfortunately already hiring teachers in homosexual relationships, once the government recognizes homosexual unions as marriages, administrators and school boards, particularly in elementary schools, will have the social stigma that makes them reluctant to hire teachers in homosexual unions knocked off from the radio. Okay, quick. I think she wins the World's Award for getting the word homosexual number of times. But, you know, sorry, Lori. Gay teachers have been around forever, and they do just a fine job of teaching our kids. And the very, very ugly FreedomWorks. According to a report published earlier today, FreedomWorks, the conservative super PAC started by Dick Armey and David Koch, created a promotional video that depicted former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton having sex with a woman dressed in a giant panda costume. The video included a scene in which a female intern wearing a panda suit was simulating this with Clinton. The video was to be played at the Free PAC conference in July of last year, but was never shown. There's now an ongoing internal investigation into the creation of the film with multiple FreedomWorks officials, including former chairman Dick Armey, claiming they had no knowledge of it. The decision to make the video shows a terrible lack of judgment within FreedomWorks. While the content of the film is a new low for conservatives, it is very, very ugly. Amazing. That's incredibly ugly. So, anyway. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Give me one second. Can you hear me okay now?
I hear you fine.
Okay. All right. If corporations are people, the NRA is a corporation, therefore there are people.
Right.
When people develop enemy lists, we consider them to be paranoid. Paranoid is a psychiatric condition.
That's right.
And we need to keep guns away from people with psychiatric conditions.
We need to. Somebody needs to come forward with a. I forget what's the name of an order to institutionalize somebody. A non compos menace is the Latin term, but commitment order. Yes, an order of commitment for the NRA. Good one, David. Thank you very much. Andrew in Ashland, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew, you wanted to talk about the Army?
Hi. Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is somewhat related to the segment you had on the previous hour, the conversation with the Tea Party activists. It's no secret that our Army not only protects us as citizens, but also plays a major role in protecting the interests of major corporations, mostly oil corporations.
Right.
And you could argue what the ratio is. You could argue that many other citizen-living countries around the world get away with being safe, you know, having half the size or a third or two-thirds of the Army that we have. But the point is, since the Army is working as either a bodyguard or a hitman in many instances of war for these major corporations, and since all of us are worried about the deficit and the national debt, we should maybe have these corporations participate in paying our military budget.
Yeah, I don't disagree. This is one of the externalities of oil. I mean, we're protecting the shipping lines, right, or the lanes, rather, for ExxonMobil. And what does ExxonMobil pay in federal income taxes? Nothing. Somehow that sucks. You know, I'm with you, Andrew. I think that, you know, that needs to be changed. Kirk in Bothell, Washington. Hey, Kirk, thanks for listening to 91.3 FM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, with the demise of our AM station, you're my progressive lifeline here, and I was hoping to talk to you about just a few things quickly. First of all, the really interesting juxtaposition, speaking of civil war, maybe the Republican Party really doesn't want to talk about the genuine civil war that's brewing with Karl Rove and Citizens United
there was a Tea Party group that sent out an email today calling Karl Rove a liberal.
Yes.
I kid you not.
Yeah, there's that. And then speaking on the sequester, you know, I'm wondering whether Jack Lew negotiated John Boehner into an incredible corner where this is just going to go past the deadline and the president will sort of dictate the terms of where we go from there.
I think that's a very real possibility, Kirk. And when John Boehner, after he negotiated the sequester with the president, bragged on live on national television that he got 98%, did he say, or 99%, 98% of everything he wanted? In fact, Shane, you got the audio of that? That's okay. We all know what he said. This is coming back to bite them, and a good thing it is. So yeah, I think Jack Lew did get the better of him, which is one of the reasons why there are some raised eyebrows on the Republican side about him, you know, moving up the food chain, as it were. Kirk, thanks a lot for the call. Raul in Berrien Springs, Michigan. Hey, Raul, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Tom, you've made a statement several times on the air that you didn't think the Civil War was needed for the emancipation of the slaves. And I think you're totally wrong in that regard, especially in light of the fact that the same people who fought the Civil War, basically the mentality, the political party, they've incarcerated more black men, young men, than there were slaves with their prison policies. And they're vehement, you know, against taking away voters' rights and destroying unions, destroying the union itself. So, Tom, how could you even, you know, think that this thing could not have been done without violence? And then even after the Civil War, Ku Klux Klans reestablished themselves through violence. What is your reasoning there, Tom?
Well, first of all, you're mischaracterizing what I said. My thoughts on the Civil War, it's not even an opinion. I mean, this is my understanding of the history of the time. Was that when the initial secession took place and the, you know, and Lincoln was confronted with, and I'm not enough of a Civil War historian to remember the name of the first action. Perhaps you are. But I believe it was in Virginia.
Charleston, South Carolina.
There you go. When that happened, my understanding is that Lincoln thought that if he put down that rebellion, he would have a 3-week war on his hands. And so he decided to engage the Confederacy. It turned into a 4-year war, and a horrible one at that. Whether he had any alternative, I don't honestly know. And I've never argued that he shouldn't have. I just have observed that he certainly didn't expect that to be as large or as massive as it turned out to be. although, you know, there were a lot of early indicators between the time that he was elected and the time that he was inaugurated, that, you know, which was a almost a 4-month period. It was, you know, from November to March of 1860. We went from one state threatening to secede to a number, I forget the exact number of states that actually had seceded or had issued formal secession, whatever they were called at the time, you know, declarations. That said, and many of them were pretty openly saying that they were doing so because they felt that a Lincoln presidency would end slavery and therefore impoverish the slave owners in the South, which, you know, was probably a legitimate complaint. My second point is that we don't, that if you really want to accomplish something, violence is generally the least efficient way or effective way to do it. Violence can be very efficient, I suppose, but Martin Luther King made more change with absolute nonviolence than, you know, the those African Americans who tried to take up arms in the 50s and 60s ever in their wildest dreams thought would happen, and in using the example of civil rights. And you know, the women's movement was a nonviolent movement. I don't see where violence solves things. Slavery was coming unraveled in the South as it was. The cotton gin, you know, being widely distributed across the South in the 1830s, the 1840s, one cotton gin could do the work of 50 slaves. You know, the value of the slaves was collapsing.
The cotton gin actually increased the need for more slaves because it put more land. They needed more land.
I know you and I have had this conversation before, and that may well that may well be the case. Are we relitigating the Civil War, really?
Well, we're never going to stop in this country, it seems. But we have to get the basic facts correct. At least from my standpoint.
Okay, and from your standpoint, the basic facts are that what that we need another war against Republicans to stop them from disenfranchising blacks in the voting roll in the voting place.
I never said that.
Okay, but all right. Raul, we're pretty much out of time. Thanks a lot for the call. I think we're going around a circle here that we've been around before. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And thanks for the comment on the cotton gin. I'm going to have to go back and look that up because you may well be right. We'll see. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Dean in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dean, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. There's something that's been on my mind for quite a few months, ever since about the middle of last year, when the term climate change started getting used. I'm really excited about the rally this Sunday in Washington, but I still just wanted to put it out there that as someone who's in the past 5 years has talked to thousands of voters working on several different Democratic campaigns and also done some fundraising, I always thought that your best bet to get people curious first and then lead them to getting concerned about the climate crisis, which is what I consider it a crisis, is to call it a climate crisis.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you have an idea of who was it that decided we were supposed to start using the term climate change, because I find it difficult to do that when I'm talking to people and really want them to get concerned about what I consider the climate crisis.
Well, I think I don't know. You know, to give you a blunt answer, my understanding is that this change in phraseology, excuse me, just a second. Pardon me, had to cough there. My understanding is that this change in phraseology came about because global warming had been adopted as the broadly used term. And while the globe is warming, the fact of the matter is that means that some parts of the globe will get more snow and might get more extreme winters. And those extreme winters and extreme winter weather events were being used by global climate change skeptics or deniers, global warming deniers, Sean Hannity used to make jokes about going out to shovel some of that climate change, you know, that kind of thing. And so scientists tend to be very conservative. And, you know, using the word crisis that's something that just the use of that kind of term would generate probably controversy within the scientific community, or at least it would have a decade ago when this change happened. So that would be my guess. But I agree with you that politically we should be using the word crisis, this climate crisis. And I'll, in fact, thank you for the reminder, Dean. I will try to start using that. And if I neglect to, please call me back. Sometimes it takes a couple of times for something to make it through through my head.
Tom, Understood. I definitely understand why they wanted to get away from global warming, because the conservatives were making fun of, like, oh, look at all this snow, must be global warming.
Right.
But so I understand wanting to get away from that. The next best one I could come up with is crazy weather syndrome, which, and I guess lately I've been hearing a similar term. I forget exactly what they're using.
What I was using for a long time was global weather weirding. And, no scientist is going to go near that. So.
Right.
Dean, thanks a lot for the call. Okay. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Walter in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Walter, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I've got a question for you, and it's been bothering me for a few weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
I know you believe sincerely in the nonviolent movement. And what I wanted to ask you is, what was more effective? Was it the nonviolent movement, or was it the violence in response to the nonviolent movement? And the reason why I'm asking this is because when I look at the discourse in Washington and the obstruction from Republicans, I noticed that when you have two sides that are entrenched in their positions, and if they're polite, typically you don't get any change, but there usually has to be one side that proposes some kind of action for the other side to change. So
right.
I really wanted to know just what.
Your point is absolutely right, and it's the violent response to nonviolence that is what's effective. Gandhi pointed this out. He said that there are four stages that a genuine revolution goes through. A genuine nonviolent revolution goes through, whether it was the beginning of Christianity or whether it was in his case throwing off the British Empire. And first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. And the then they fight you part is, when they can no longer ignore you and people aren't taking serious the ridicule, then the battle gets engaged. And if you can hold on to your nonviolent principles, then in the minds of all the observers, they become the center of evil and you become the center of good, to use, screenwriting metaphor. And that's when you win, if you're the nonviolent movement. Make sense?
It does. Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call, Walter. I appreciate it. Cheryl in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Cheryl, you got a wind tower?
What? What's that?
You have a wind tower? How cool is that?
Back in the early 80s, I was getting my bachelor's degree in political science at Pitzer College, and they had a class called Solar Colloquium.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned there encouraged my husband and I to invest in buying half of a wind tower.
Wow.
And I wanted to say that we got monthly dividend checks from that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Carter was in, and he had given lots of incentives for alternative energy startups.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, right after he left, Reagan ended those, and all those companies collapsed. But what I wanted to say is it was a really good investment for, we didn't have a lot of money. I mean, I was a student, but we had enough money to buy into this wind tower and still, get income. And so I thought that's a good incentive for more people to, become involved. And it's another way to become involved in helping this alternative energy movement.
Yeah, and I think that as more and more private companies start getting involved in developing alternative energy and in doing alternative energy, and community groups start forming, co-ops start forming. I mean, I see an entire economy. Well, actually, not coming. There already is an entire economy based on this, but I see it as growing, and I think that it would be an area that is definitely worth investing in. And you are going
to
see
returns. I just wanted to say that my son is doing his senior thesis on the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. That's great. Good work on him. Good on him. Cheryl, thank you very much for the call. And thanks for watching the program there on Free Speech TV. And don't forget, this Sunday, here in Washington, D.C., this big, you know, climate change meeting, summit, protest on the National Mall. It's going to be huge, and you can learn more about it at, well, there's a bunch of different websites, but you can learn more about it at sierraclub.org. And coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, anything goes on Town Hall Friday. Bernie was with us today, so tomorrow it's going to be just anything goes. Your chance to sound off the topics and issues of the week along with the news of the day and the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.